Welcome to the Newsbusters podcast with the executive editor of Newsbusters, your host, Tim Graham.
Hello, and welcome to the Newsbusters podcast, where we are now embroiled in the confirmation hearings for Amy Coney Barrett, or as we call her, ACB. The liberals don't like that. Don't take our RBG and turn it into ACB. Well, we won't call Barrett notorious like it's a good thing. Let's take our Supreme Court justice, name them after a gangster rapper who got shot in the street in a gang war. Yeah. I think maybe the surprise here is it quickly got rather sedate. This has been no Kavanaugh hearings, maybe because the Kavanaugh hearings didn't exactly work out the way the Democrats wanted them to. And it's a lot harder to go after a woman the way that they went after Kavanaugh. I thought, for example, the first day where Barrett mostly listened to opening statements, but that had her opening statement, and you go to the Washington Post, and the headline over the story was, Barrett pledges to be apolitical justice. I mean, that's just about as neutral as it can get. It is not what I would have expected. Now, obviously, the subhead's more like, you know, hearing kicks off partisan fight. Accurate. But I think generally the coverage has been subdued. And you could sense this early on when Justice Ginsburg died. There was this undercurrent of, oh, well, this is probably going to be fairly easy for the Senate to do. I think that they have enough understanding of Mitch McConnell to think this will proceed quickly and the Democrats will really have no way to stop it. Therefore, and it does present, with this much time left in the campaign calendar, a kind of a sticky wicket for the Democrats. And that is, they can't go full Kavanaugh on this woman at a time when people are already voting. And they, of course, they come around and they try to complain and say, this is unprecedented. We've never had a hearing when there's people already voting. Well, first of all, that's your idea. Most of us would rather have elections on Election Day. It's the Democrats that want to have 67 days of voting. We like voting so much, let's do it for 67 days. And maybe you can vote two or three times. It really has been subdued, because I think to some degree that Judge Barrett has presented herself in a very dignified way. She's demonstrated her intelligence. The American Bar Association declared her well qualified because, well, how can they not? But this is the whole funny thing, is that the ABA in recent years seems to decide to some degree how qualified you are based on where you come down on the issues. I think they just found it hard that they couldn't really do that in this case. So, I mean, there's still a lot of complaining. There's still a lot of suggestion that somehow Barrett will, I mean, let's run down the Democratic list of complaints. Barrett will overturn Roe versus Wade. Barrett will overturn Obamacare. All these things that are guaranteed to motivate the Democrats. Barrett signed an advertisement about barbaric Roe versus Wade in the paper in South Bend. What they all tend to leave out of this is this whole story about the abortionist in that neighborhood. When he passed away, they found in his garage just hundreds of fetal remains. And that's what barbaric refers to. Somehow the Democrats and the left always presume that abortion is a sacred choice and never face what actually happens. It's the same kind of discomfort they had when David Daleiden had the hidden camera tapes with Planned Parenthood, where they just made jokes about crushing skulls and selling body parts. That's not a place they want to live. The same way that the liberal media and their fact-checking allies could not stand the idea that Governor Ralph Northam could clumsily discuss how, when a baby's already been born, if you want the right to choose to dispose of the baby that's already been born, it's somehow unfair or unfactual to discuss this. It's called, I'm sorry, the debate's going to be on our terms now. The liberal media never likes that. The liberal media doesn't like discussing things in a way in which they feel at a disadvantage, and that's when they call it misinformation. One of the other things that's going on right now is breaking. The New York Times had a story that came out in the last 12 or 18 hours on Dan Bongino and Mark Levin and Trump somehow trying to suggest they're misinforming people. The headline in the Times was, "Riled up, misinformation stokes calls for violence on Election Day." Subheadline, "Baseless claims are circulating online about a Democrat-led coup, inflaming tensions in an already turbulent election season." Ponder that for a minute. Since when is the New York Times innocent of inflaming, they never inflame tensions. They never make the election season turbulent. They never have conspiracy theories. They never inspire violence or seem awfully casual about violence. And as you might expect, Dan Bongino and Mark Levin on their social media have been quite aggressive in answering back. Now, this concerns a group called the Transition Integrity Project, which is a group of academics that have basically suggested that the only way to avoid a violent aftermath of the election is, conveniently, a Biden landslide. Wouldn't that be helpful? Wouldn't that be just what America needs at this juncture? So we know that Bongino and Levin will be all over this and kind of enjoying it. But I think what it underlines here is the New York Times and the rest of the liberal media, when it comes to the social media, whether it's YouTube, whether it's Facebook, whether it's Twitter, the so-called mainstream media is always trying to curtail the conservative media on social media. They're always trying to get big tech to clamp down, to put warning labels on, to put fact checks on what they decide is misinformation because they don't like the information. We are talking about a prediction of what's going to happen in the election. And yes, you can say you are inflaming tensions when you say, for example, as the president does, that mail-in voting's not going to work out, that it's a playground for fraud. It is a prediction. You might not like the prediction. You might think that the prediction is unsettling. But is it a prediction? How can a prediction be described as misinformation? Now, you can misinform people about how mail-in voting works. But if you're predicting that this election's going to be rife with fraud, that's a prediction. Therefore, it can't be described as unfactual. But this is where it gets really slippery and the kind of mud that the media loves to play in, which is it's okay for us to lose our hair over the idea that Trump's not going to concede the election, which is also a conspiracy theory, which also inflames tensions, which also makes the world turbulent. And they wallowed in that for a week or something. So it's just kind of bizarre when the New York Times has a reporter assigned to the topic of digital misinformation, and just like PolitiFact, just like Snopes, this is a person who's going to go around trying to say the right-wing media is misleading you, including when it comes to Antifa. This same reporter, Davey Alba, is all about, oh, right-wing myths about Antifa violence. Huh? It's a myth that these people are violent? Left-wing looting and rioting, misinformation? this is where, again, you have to take into account just the dramatic bias of the press and the dramatic way that they're always confusing information with misinformation. If it's information they don't agree with, somehow it's misinformation. Now, one of the other things I wanted to discuss, because I really hate to discuss the coronavirus. I try to obey all of the rules. I can socially distance. I can wear my mask. And frankly, when I talk, I sound like a super spreader. So I try to be a good boy. And the thing I especially hate the most, I mean, I sing in a church choir. I love to sing. And I was watching the Today Show this morning, and it was all about, you know, they're going to crack down on holiday gatherings. And they were sort of encouraging. The scientists tell us no singing. This is one of those things where, again, when you rail about the science of this, you're not anti-science. You're basically saying, I don't like the way that people use science with a capital S to say, you can't do this and you can't do that and you can't do this. I mean, you know, I've got Mrs. Graham's science with a capital S in my house. Well, you know, don't be a rebel. I'll wear the mask when I need to wear the mask. I'm not going to wear it outside. I'm not going to wear it in my car. I got such a kick out of that with Donald Trump. He gets back to his house at the White House and takes off his mask. And CNN was like, this is going to kill people. You know, I mean, John Berman was just losing his. They should have actually sort of put a nice straitjacket on him and escorted him out of the studio. The idea that you get home, you take off your mask, you're outside, you're like 30 feet away from everyone. Yeah, you're posing for the cameras. But he wasn't killing anybody. Anyway, coronavirus. Something surprising happened here again in the New York Times, that the Science Times section asked the question, the coronavirus is an end in sight. So if you go to the New York Times on page D4 on Tuesday, you get a whole story about how there's actually a light on at the end of the tunnel. The federal government's vaccine program, Operation Warp Speed, is actually working with great efficiency. Really? Because when we watch the news, they are always hyping how terrible things are going to be. And they never really apologize for things when they don't work out according to their doom-mongering predictions. Yeah, remember these people all being like, we'll never have enough ventilators. Well, we've always had enough ventilators. Now we kind of have a ventilator surplus. We're exporting ventilators. And of course, people have decided that ventilators is, you're in bad shape when by the time you need one, they're going to try to keep you off of one. That's like a last resort. And the reporter in this story, the New York Times has said, I've been a gloomy Cassandra on this, and now I'm getting more optimistic. Well, why can't that, from the New York Times, the paper of record, as we've just described, the people who are against quote-unquote misinformation, why isn't CNN picking this up? Where is John Berman on Operation Warp Speed, the vaccine program? And of course, what we can do here at Newsbusters is do a search of our SnapStream video system, which gives us closed captioning. It's not a transcript, but they're notes. Sometimes the closed captioning is very, very good, and sometimes it's terrible, so you don't know. But I put Operation Warp Speed into the closed captioning search, and on Cuomo Primetime, Dr. Leanna Wen, the former Planned Parenthood exec, who now they always just refer to as a emergency room physician, said, yeah, let's give the Trump administration credit for Operation Warp Speed. It's like a sentence. That's about what you're going to get. Because they're kind of allergic to the good news. I am going to take whatever shred of good news I can get out of this. And look, here in Virginia, it's been on a pretty good trend. in when you look at the death toll, even nationwide, we're on a good trend. Our media obsesses over case counts, and they've also talked about hospitalizations. That, to me, is a more real measurement than just case counts. But can we have just a little bit of optimism? That would be very nice. I am just dying for some good news, but it's a mess out there. Here with us to discuss what's going on in Newsbusters land is Bill D'Agostino, one of our many employees at the Media Research Center who started as interns and then became full-time employees.
Mm-hmm.
Bill is the video whiz who makes fun videos a la like the Free Beacon does. We were like, we need a Free Beacon guy. And we enjoy that. And so, Bill, you attended Ithaca College. You said there's a story there.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. How's it going, Tim? Yeah, I mean, initially the question was, where did you graduate? And I said, well, nowhere. But yeah, I attended Ithaca College. They have a pretty good film school there, which is not usually where people who end up at conservative organizations end up going. Film school was kind of a very liberal place.
Well, we need conservatives in film school. Isn't that Olbermann's alma mater?
It could be. I hope not, but I could see that being true. Yeah, what a guy. No, but I was pretty close to graduating. It had the standard core requirements that most colleges, most liberal arts-esque colleges do these days. And one of the core requirements was a diversity credit. And you had to kind of select the classes that fulfilled each of your core requirements when you were, you know, applying for this final little elective or module that you had to take to basically qualify to graduate. And I selected this African art history class that I'd taken. I thought, well, that's, you know, definitely not in my comfort zone usually.
Right.
It feels like it would meet the diversity requirement. And I received an email back informing me that it didn't meet the requirement and a rubric telling me what diversity meant for the purpose of that requirement. And it was basically you have to take a social justice class. Mm-hmm. It was you have to be familiar with institutional power structures and how they affect different peoples and be able to articulate blah, 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 blah.
Ugh.
And so I responded saying, I'll write you an essay on what those things are and why I disagree with them and why I don't think I should have to take this class because this is now political programming. This is not education. And they said, no. And they let me walk at graduation. That was fun. But yeah, I didn't end up getting the degree because of that.
Well, you're 98% of the way there.
That's right, and I got the education out of it, which was the main thing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, this is one of the things that I went to college back in the 80s,
right?
And we didn't have the, I mean, and I went to in Bemidji, Minnesota, was not exactly a hotbed of left wing radicalism, although the professors there were pretty standard. You know, back then they would say, oh, the Sandinistas, what do they have to teach us?
Right.
But it wasn't like this. I would take classes to troll them.
Huh.
The one I enjoyed was called History of Peace Movements.
Oh, God.
And they were like, why are you here? And I was respectful, but I was there, you know, they would bring in speakers from the quote-unquote peace movement, and I would kind of toy with them, but
well, that sounds fun.
We're here to talk about what you do. The most recent video you made was Thomas Friedman, a columnist for the New York Times, who before that was a distinguished foreign correspondent, but for many years now has been kind of this pompous pundit that you used to see, you know, almost weekly on the Charlie Rose Show.
Mm.
But you kind of have an ear out for phrases. When you're making videos, a lot of times you're like, I'm looking for a trend. I'm looking for what caught your ear.
Absolutely. I mean, there's this thing that a lot of reporters do, or not reporters, rather, but recurring guests on these news shows do, where they come up with something and you can just see the self-satisfaction glinting in their eyes. They think that they have just got a winner here, and they are so excited to use it at every opportunity when they go on the air. And Thomas Friedman was doing that. He's been using this one line: "We have a president without shame," and it goes on from there. And a party without, what is it, scruples or something? Whatever.
And sometimes he throws Fox News in.
That's right. Yeah.
But what you do that's so much fun is when you it's something most of us can't do, which is like layer it on layer, where it's like five versions of Tom Friedman all saying president without shame at the same time.
A president without shame.
When you have a president without shame.
We have a
president without shame.
That is so powerful.
Yeah, I think in this video there were actually 12 instances of him saying it simultaneously. It was a little spooky, actually.
Yes, for the old people, it reminds us of the Breck Girl ads. You would know nothing about that.
It's kind of like a... like an awful liberal Brady Bunch.
Yeah. If you multiply the Brady Bunch by 2, and if it's 12.
Right.
But yes. So, I mean, this is something that one of the things that you also were involved in was digging back into the video era before you were born, which was the Joe Biden plagiarism scandal of 1987. That's still a good video we would urge you to check out.
Well, yeah, and if that's a piece that to make a point against plagiarism, then that's a gift that just keeps on giving, because it's been stolen twice now so far.
Yeah.
Once actually by Sean King, the former justice reporter for New York Magazine, and I think he had something to do with the Young Turks at some point. Anyway, he took our video back when, you know, during the primaries, and just sliced the Newsbusters bumper off at the end so that it ends very abruptly, and tweeted it out. That was kind of exciting for me.
It's the tribute left-wing vice turns, yeah, you know, right-wing virtue. But, I mean, look, Joe Biden's run for president so many times. And this is where we, you know, us oldsters always kick in and say, oh, you guys don't know Joe Biden in the 80s.
Mm.
You know, we're going to remember the debates in 87 where they were all railing about the trillions and trillions of dollars that would be wasted on a Star Wars defense system.
Right.
You know, I mean, all this kind of stuff, which is, all of that's antique now, just like discussing the Sandinistas' social justice idealism. I was going to suggest, talk for a minute to you about the column that I did, because the author of this particular article has just turned 30, and yet she is called a senior correspondent at Time Magazine. So when you're a seasoned citizen, you always find this kind of funny, like senior correspondent. Basically, her article in Time Magazine this week was about how the voters and their unlogic, well, it projects a lack of confidence in the outcome. But she went out and interviewed people in the hinterlands.
I know where this is going.
And I was searching for her on Twitter yesterday, and I just found this particular tweet quite enjoyable. She said, "You think voter logic is like A is greater than B is greater than C is greater than D. But in actuality, voter logic is more like A," and maybe this is not greater, maybe it relates to, but it looks like the greater sign.
Right.
"A
right.
is greater than purple is greater than banana is greater than 18. I mean, she's basically suggesting, I went and interviewed a bunch of voters, and they're all kind of nuts.
Mm.
I don't have confidence in this democracy because the people I spoke with really shouldn't have the franchise.
Well, forgive me for profiling a 30-year-old senior correspondent who works for Time. My guess is that she is a bleeding heart liberal.
Yeah.
And it sounds a little bit like this is a case of, God, these dumb rubes just won't support the stuff that I support. I don't have confidence in American voters. And that's kind of a common thing, I feel like, with a lot of younger liberals. Well, I guess all liberals, but especially younger liberals, is that this disdain and frustration with what they perceive as clueless or, you know, low information or unintelligent conservatives if they could only see.
Yeah.
What I understand, if they could only understand it too, if they just weren't so dumb, then they would vote the right way. And that also kind of gets us into this dichotomy that has existed as long as the liberal-conservative dichotomy has, which is they always see us as either too stupid to understand their opinions and their platform, or evil, where we understand it, but we refuse to support it even though it's the right thing because we're too self-interested to do so.
Yeah, I think I would suggest that that is like the dichotomy between the news media's portrayal of George W. Bush, dumb, versus Newt Gingrich, evil, not dumb enough to actually believe all this stuff, just plain evil. You know, they've never liked Republican candidates for president who seemed too smart. This is why I would posit that in 2015 they all gravitated to trying to promote Trump because they figured Hillary is so smart and he is so dumb. That is ideal. We don't want her running against Ted Cruz.
Right.
Because Ted Cruz might actually embarrass her in a debate. Therefore, let's go with Trump. And so, you know, the whole comedy of the Trump era that we can all describe to the next generation is these people all thought Trump will be easy to defeat, so let's promote this guy.
Right. They elevated him so much during the primary. I mean, look no further than Joe and Mika. Good Lord. The 180 that happened after the primaries was insane.
Well, I mean, this is kind of the funny thing is, yes, the writer of this article is named Charlotte Alter, and of course,
Jonathan
Alter's daughter.
Huh.
And I'm, of course, am never a person that should say that your child should not follow you into your similar career.
Right, as your son records this podcast.
Or as we, you know, Brent Bozell and his distinguished son David Bozell at For America. You know, I mean, there's that's fine. But yes, I mean, Jonathan Alter, again, we're talking about Thomas Friedman. I mean, Jonathan Alter is another one of these guys who would often show up on the Charlie Rose show to do all the late night liberalism and who...
That's good, late night liberalism.
Yeah, who wrote two books on Obama. The funny one was called, after he was elected, The Center Holds.
Mm.
Obama, he was the center.
Right.
Now, if Obama's the center... I mean, this is where we put the media today, is they think that Joe Biden is the center. That they think it's an effective argument when Joe Biden says, do I look like a socialist?
Right. It's the way they back it up is, we found this blue-haired college kid over here who's far to the left of Biden, so how could he not be center? It's like, well, sure, if that's your comparison. But, yeah, I mean, Biden is kind of this man who is... he's standing there on the rug, you know, halfway down the left side of the rug, and the left just yanked the rug out from under him, and he got pulled along with it,
yeah,
completely cluelessly. There was this really tragic and kind of funny moment when he was at—I don't know if it was some event or a press appearance or what—but he was at a college, and some college kid comes up to him and says, "How many genders are there?" And Biden doesn't know what he's
What's
supposed to say to that.
Yeah.
But he knows that male and female is the wrong answer. And so this poor old guy, he just says, there's at least three. And
how's that? Do
and,
I pass?
And she had some follow-up and got kind of mad and kind of like touched him. And he was like, hey, like, you know, so stop. And, you know, did the weird, the whole Biden thing. But yeah, it was so sad to see. It was, you know, oh, there's at least three. It's this man just doing his best to understand what these ideas he's supposedly running on even are and just failing miserably at it.
It just reminds me of one of our freelancers at Newsbusters found this great piece of video with Katie Turr. And Katie Turr at MSNBC goes out to Staten Island to interview the weird people. This is a little like a Charlotte Alter journey.
Right.
Instead, she just didn't want to go to Michigan. She was just going to go over to Staten Island. And, she thought it was just wild misinformation that these people all seem to think Biden was a puppet of the left.
What?
That Biden was going to do what Bernie Sanders wanted. Where do these people get this stuff? And it's called, well, Biden and Bernie Sanders made a platform together.
They literally had policy people working together, and Bernie commended him on numerous policy points for giving ground to what Bernie's people wanted.
I wanted to say to you as we wrap this up, I'm going to give people a little hint for you Newsbusters fans what Bill's working on now, which is a if I may betray what's coming, coming attractions.
Feel free.
In a world where Joe Biden's still considered serious, a video on just reminding everybody just how unglued the media's been about Trump. Anything you'd like to say as we wrap that thing up?
Well, keep your eyes peeled for it. It's kind of a best of or worst of, depending on where you're sitting, I guess. But it starts with a bunch of people repeating that this is the worst president in American history, and the goal is that it then goes downhill from there. And I think we actually did a pretty good job getting a lot of things that actually are kind of worse than that. It's sort of incredible. You have to be able to laugh at it a little bit. I know I showed you an earlier cut, and you seem to be having a good time with it. Some of this unbridled rage that they have for him is so ridiculous that if you can't just kind of take a step back and chuckle at them, you're not going to have a good time.
Well,
so
people always ask us, like, how can you watch this stuff day after day? How can you immerse yourself in this? And yeah, you obviously have to, on some level, find it amusing. I think that a lot of experience, I mean, again, just the mere fact that Donald Trump got elected, just the mere fact that, for example, that the Republicans actually held the Senate in the midterms, it tells you that floods of media bias don't always have their intended effect. So then they write the articles about unlogic. What's right. wrong with those voters?
Right. Why didn't we convince them properly? Why didn't they get it? We tried so hard. That's just basically what they're saying.
And this is kind of a theme here, but they always think that democracy's health is measured by how successful the Democrats are. And our democracy is dying in darkness when the Democrats don't win.
Right. Democracy is failing whenever the guy we didn't want gets in office.
I do project that when and if the Democrats win the presidency, suddenly all of those slogans are going to vanish. The Washington Post is going to come up with something else to put on their T-shirts and onesies.
Well, I actually think we might have another 4 years of wondering about that. But
yes.
That's, call me crazy.
That is quite possible. We are continuing to chronicle it here at Newsbusters. So come see us once a day, twice a day, maybe 24 times a day. Thanks for listening.